willows. A raven croaked overhead, startling her. Suddenly, the crucifer orb lit up in Forshee's hand. It emanated a soft glow, just enough to spread a ring of radiance to guide their steps.
"He'll see us coming," the captain warned.
"He already knows we're coming,"
Colton answered seriously.
"He's waiting."
"We're walking into a trap, then?"
"You could say that,"
he replied.
"You are not a military man, Forshee. We need a strategy and a plan. He's got a weapon that belches fire and can kill a Maston."
"I know,"
Colton answered.
"He shot the Alder Maston. How have your strategies worked thus far, Captain? You have the men, you have the Zephyrs. I was brought here because I have the ability to find him. Trust me a little further."
The captain looked angered by the rebuke.
"With all due respect, Lord Forshee, I outrank you. What we are doing is folly. We need to flank him, to—"
Colton's eyes blazed with sudden anger, but he held it in check.
"Captain,"
he said softly.
"They can hear you. Have a little more confidence in me."
"At least tell me what your plan is,"
the captain snarled. Colton shook his head no.
"If we do not act now, there is a strong likelihood she will be killed." "Captain,"
said Juliana curtly. She gave him a warning look and a shake of her head like he was being a daft fool.
"Thank you,"
Colton told her. He kept going without a backward glance, and everyone else followed. The night air was getting colder, but their rapid pace kept Seti from being too cold. She could still sense the ghosts, but most of them were trailing the group. Only the tall one lurked somewhere ahead. There was a sense of giddiness about it, as if the creature were savoring an upcoming victory. It attempted to torture her with its thoughts, but she focused her memory on some of the passages she had learned from tomes during her stay at Mirwood. The mind could only think of one thing at a time, and she had every right to control what those thoughts would be. They were far from the abbey now, deep in the heart of the woods. She knew the abbey was surrounded by water, that they would eventually reach the shore. And as she recited the quotes in her mind, she listened keenly for the sound of water lapping. Colton looked down at the orb once more and stopped short.
"He's left her."
"What?"
Juliana demanded.
"It tells me she is one way, and he is another. He's reacting to our movements."
He paused, gazing intently at the surface of the orb. Once again, Seti could see a strange script scrawled across it.
"Captain, send half of your men into the woods that way."
He straightened his arm and pointed to his left.
"He's circling around to come up behind us. Have them wait to ambush him. He may be invisible. Listen carefully, use your instincts. The rest will rush ahead to rescue the girl while she's alone. Summon the Zephyrs to us, we're ready for reinforcements."
"It's about bloody time,"
the captain snarled, raising his wrist to his mouth. Then he selected six of his men to make the attack.
"Capture him if you can. Your orders are to kill him otherwise."
"Where's Anna?"
Juliana asked Lord Forshee.
"This way,"
Colton said, and started to jog. The captain went with them, along with the rest of the soldiers. The light from the orb grew brighter as they ran. Seti could feel the ghosts hissing, shrinking back from the brightness that tortured them. There was pain in their thoughts, and Seti felt a gush of vengefulness in her heart. She stayed near Juliana and Colton, surrounded by the soldiers and their weapons. There would be violence soon. She sensed it, felt the wind hold its breath in anticipation.
"Over here!"
It was Anna's voice. Colton led them straight toward the sound. The clack and clatter of branches obscured their way, but Seti batted the limbs aside in her eagerness to get to her sister. Then she saw the golden hair, the filthy dress. Anna cowered at the base of a tree, shielding her eyes from the brightness of the light. Something felt wrong. A warning pulsed inside of Seti's heart.
"Anna!"
Juliana called in relief. They rushed up to her, the light from the orb blazing like the noonday sun. Seti looked around for signs of Anna's abductor. The soldiers had their arquebuses aimed into the woods as they encircled the girl. Colton knelt beside her. She wasn't bound or tied by anything. Seti rushed forward to hug her, but Anna shocked her by lunging forward and grabbing Colton by the throat. Her eyes were shining silver, and a snarl of hatred twisted her pretty mouth. At that moment, an explosion blasted in the woods, followed by a sharp cry of pain from one of the soldiers. Anna rose and threw Colton into the tree with inhuman strength. As soon as he struck the wood, he dropped the Crusader orb. Everything went dark except for Anna's eyes.
"You bring six against a legion?"
said the tall ghost, speaking through Anna. Its voice echoed strangely, making Seti's skin crawl. Anna struck the captain as he turned around to look at her, and Seti heard his jawbone crack with the blow. The soldiers turned their weapons on her.
"Don't!"
Juliana shrieked. Seti had only been this afraid twice before. The first time was when she'd entered the grotto near the Dalkoeth mines. Her presence had awoken a horrible beast that lurked there, and it had reached out to her, tried to control her. The second was when Mrs. Pullman had brought the tall ghost into Anna's room at Fog Willows. She couldn't move, couldn't think. She was blind and mute once again. Anna let out a screeching sound and ripped an arquebus out of the hands of a terrified soldier before clubbing him with it.
"Anna, stop!"
Juliana screamed. Then she rushed at her, ducking beneath the arquebuses and using the technique of butterfly hands to strike her in the middle. Juliana didn't stop there. She'd been trained by Raj Saran to attack with her hands and her feet. She struck Anna three or four times in a blur before getting struck by the butt of the weapon and knocked down. There was more commotion in the woods as the Kishion attacked the soldiers who had been left behind. A wave of fear spread from Anna. The soldiers standing nearby looked terrified, even though they were the ones holding weapons. Should they shoot Minister Fitzroy's daughter to save themselves? Could they bring themselves to harm an innocent being controlled by an evil entity? Light. Light held the ghosts at bay. Seti searched the area, even though she still couldn't turn her head, until she saw where the Crusader orb had fallen, its music now silent. Instinctually, she knew it would obey her. She needed to lunge for it, to pick it up. But fear had frozen her in place. Fitzroy wasn't there to save her this time. She couldn't move. Then a memory from long ago surfaced. Back at the grotto, it was Adam who had saved her from the beast's call. She remembered the sound of his voice, his coaxing way. He had pulled her from her own grasping fear. In her mind, she saw his smiling face. It was a vision that stabbed into the darkest part of her soul. Just one of his smiles could do that to her. Adam had saved her then. It was Adam she wanted now, in this moment of fright and uncertainty. If only he were here and not with the other soldiers from the ministry.
Seti.
She felt the distant pulse of his thought. They were far enough away from each other that it startled her, but something had connected them.
Seti, where are you? You're in danger.
She felt his worry, felt his concern. And then, suddenly, she could move. Anna flung the arquebus at another soldier, striking him in the head and knocking him down. The soldiers who were still standing eyed each other with uncertainty, and one of them took a step forward. There was no time to dally. Seti lunged for the Crusader orb. As soon as her fingers touched it, light exploded from it, blinding her with its radiance. Anna screamed in pain as if 1,000 knives had cut her at once. The ghosts were still everywhere around them, but they scattered like black leaves in a storm. The woods were flooded with light again. A keening noise came in her ears.
No, no,
Anna screeched in her otherworldly voice. A hand gripped Seti's wrist. Colton was on his knees beside her, blood streaming from a cut on his brow. He looked intense and committed. His eyes were fixed on the blinding white orb.
"I name you Ashfordel. Depart," he said boldly.
Another scream.
"I name you Havilah. Depart."
You cannot command me, Anna shrieked.
I name you Belkin. I name you Kriznen. Depart.
The scream that followed drowned out Colton's words, but still he spoke, naming the ghosts one by one. Anna's body started to convulse and shake, her eyes rolling back in her head. She began to tear at herself with her own nails. Ceti cringed and gaped, horrified by the sight of her lovely, radiant sister doing herself injury. But she joined her power with Colton's, and the light only grew brighter. One of the soldiers dropped his arquebus and fled into the night.
I name you.
No! No!
And then Anna crumpled to the forest floor, pale as death, bleeding from the wounds she had scored in herself. The ghosts were all gone. In the light of the Crusader orb, Ceti watched as the man who'd claimed to be her father strode forward, his face full of enmity. Colton struggled to his feet, and Ceti came up with him. There were only two soldiers left, and the Kishian struck them both down with well-aimed jabs. Juliana stepped in front of him, drawing her blades.
You cannot have them,
she spat at him. The Kishian looked at her coldly, his scar twitching as he frowned. He drew his pistol and aimed it at her face.
I have come for what is rightfully mine. You will not corrupt her. Stand aside. Do as he says, Juliana,
Colton said warningly.
I will not,
she answered, her voice throbbing.
Juliana, please,
Colton said.
Trust me.
I'll go with him, Ceti declared. Please, don't hurt anyone else.
She heard the music again. It was rising inside of Colton as he stared at the Kishion. He still had a firm grip on her wrist, and she sensed that he had no intention of letting her go.
Trust me,
he thought to her. Juliana, gazing down the barrel of the pistol, slowly stepped aside. There was nothing between them now.
Die, Mastin,
the Kishian said coldly. His look hardened. Ceti knew he would pull the trigger. The Kishian was plucked off his feet. There was a groan and the crackle of branches. It was as if the tree had suddenly come alive and seized him. The Kishian was immediately obscured by the leaves and limbs, and he grunted in surprise at the realization that he was well and truly entangled.
Get Anna!
Colton shouted to Juliana as he pulled Ceti away from the tree, which continued to whip and flail around. She felt the power course through his body as his grip tightened on her wrist. Juliana scooped up Anna's prone form as the captain and several of the wounded soldiers crawled away. The pistol belched fire and the ball zipped past them. Smoke and stinking fumes came next, reminding Ceti of the night the Aldermaston had been shot. The Kishion thrashed against his confinement. Lights from Zephyrs started to shine from overhead. The captain couldn't speak, but he raised his wrist to his mouth. More light began to shine down, and Ceti's heart filled with hope. The Kishian let out a roar of rage, and suddenly the entire tree was engulfed in flames.
Back! Farther back!
Colton warned. It was a frightening sight, and the waves of heat blasted Ceti in the face, singeing her. One of the soldiers caught fire and began shrieking in pain. The Kishian emerged from the fire unscathed, his eyes glowing silver. Colton met his gaze with a look of determination. Suddenly another tree wrenched its limbs around and tried to grapple the Kishian. The man dived to the side in time to escape its embrace, but the whole woods swayed. The fire from the one tree was spreading to others.
I have the whole grove to command,
Colton warned. A zipping noise sounded, and a ball tore through the trees, landing by the Kishion's foot. He glanced down as more shots began to rain down. He looked at Ceti in rage and desperation. But even he knew he was outmatched as the Zephyrs and their soldiers closed in. The Kishion shook his head at her, as if she were making a grievous mistake. And then he turned and bolted into the woods, dodging the trees that tried to grasp him. Juliana set Anna down safely away from the burning trees, fingers touching the young woman's scratched-up throat. A look of fury and resentment crossed her face, and then she charged into the woods after the Kishion.
At Mirwood, as at other abbeys of learning, we teach truths that will unlock the power of the mysteries in our students' lives. A first-year learner is taught that everything begins with a thought. They begin a regimen of study and meditation to gain control of their own minds. Second-year learners are taught that their thoughts, mixed with strong emotions, begin to awaken the seeds of connection to the knowing within them. And some begin to see evidence of growth in their lives. A third-year student is taught the importance of their interactions with their fellow creatures, how slights and insults can permanently harm others' thinking, as well as how praise and cooperation can achieve matters of great significance. Some students, especially the proud, are quick to exploit this knowledge for ill. The fourth-year learner is taught the importance of time, the law of the harvest, and how certain powers only unlock after much dedication and effort. Some powers require years to master. Others require a lifetime. But an acorn will never produce an apple tree. All these teachings prepare a student to face the final test, to learn a mystery that is concealed from the world at large. In doing so, they face a deep fear. It masters them, or they master it. Words are but symbols. Hearken, then, to words of the ancients, words that every first-year learner reads but only 1 in 10,000 ever puts to use. We search the tomes, and we have many insights and even a share of the gift of foretelling. And, having this guidance, we obtain power by hope, and our faith becomes unshakable, so much so that we truly can command the very trees to obey us, or the mountains, or the waves of the sea.
Thomas Abraham, Aldermaston of Mirwood Abbey. Sarah. Chapter 22. Pavenham Sky. Sarah had never been invited to Pavenham Sky before, and she was nervous about the visit. Hugild had fussed over which gown she should wear and how to arrange her hair. It was common knowledge that Lady Corinne set the fashions in the realm. When she chose a new dressmaker, that person became a celebrity, and every other fashionable woman sought to imitate her choices. She was the wife of the wealthiest man in the empire, Admiral Lawton, though some argued that Lord Fitzroy was quickly gaining ground because of his and Seti's miraculous invention. The ability to predict storms was certainly a profitable endeavor. Pavenham Sky was a floating manor above the western coast of Comoros. It was the largest manor in the realm, with extensive grounds and tiered parks. Of course, the Lawtons also had a manor at Lochhaven, but it was Pavenham Sky that was the envy of all other elite families. There was no other place like it, and Sarah leaned over the balcony of the Tempest as it made its approach, anxious to catch her first glimpse of it. She wished Seti were there to see it as well, to share the experience. Surely her friend deserved some relaxation after the upheavals at Mirwood. She would have suggested it, if only Lady Corinne were not so averse to people from the lower classes. Or to people in general, she thought with disdain. The day of Will Russell and the hedge maze, she'd witnessed a private meeting between her father and Lady Corinne. Though she did not understand how, the meeting had resulted in a rift between her parents. Of course, it was out of the question to ask Lady Corinne about it. Mr. Durant had warned her to be cautious about what she told the powerful woman. Her influence ran deep.
"Not so close to the railing, Sarah. The wind will whip your hair loose."
Hugild was always worried about appearances. "Then you can fix it," Sarah replied, not budging. They'd been on board for several hours as the Tempest cruised swiftly over the valleys and hamlets. They would arrive in time for a luncheon. Sarah knew she was to be introduced to Lady Corinne's set that day,
along with all the other young ladies under consideration to be married to the Prince of King Fountain. Some of the girls, Sarah had heard, were regulars at Pavenham Sky, which was how they had come to be considered for such an opportunity. Although Sarah was eager for the visit, she couldn't shake a feeling of uncertainty. The Lawtons had a reputation, after all. The Admiral was a shrewd man of business. He had left the Ministry of War at the age of 40 and married a much younger woman, Lady Corinne. Some said she was an heiress who had brought part of the fortune herself. Others said that it was merely her beauty that had entranced him. Everyone agreed that they had found, in each other, a partnership and companionship that had catapulted Admiral Lawton to his great success. There was no end to his ventures. He never lost in a speculation, either, having the uncanny ability to invest early to his gain and to divest before trouble started. Pavenham Sky was the symbol of their wealth and glory. It was unsurpassed, even among the Sky Manors. "What do you know of Lady Corinne's background?" Sarah asked Hugild after realizing her mind had wandered quite far afield.
"Only what I've already told you, Sarah," Hugild said with an exasperated smile. "I don't know the true story. I don't know that anyone does."
"Do you remember that day at the hedge maze?" Sarah asked. Hugild's look darkened.
"I think of it every day, Sarah.
I came upon Father talking to Lady Corinne. She had come by to see him, to share some news. I thought it strange back then that Father was meeting her so privately. I wish I could remember what they'd talked about. Whatever it was, it made things worse between my parents."
"I wouldn't put anything past her," Hugild said. "I've heard that earning her disapproval is a costly mistake, one that can have repercussions that last for years."
"I know," Sarah said. "Lord Fitzroy's wife, Lady Merrin, was such a person. All because she was upset when the young man who was courting her chose another. I think it's sad that one woman can tarnish someone's reputation so easily. Don't you think it is strange that she hasn't reached out to me before this?" Hugild shook her head, folding her arms.
"I don't think it's strange at all. She doesn't want you to become empress."
Sarah looked at her in surprise. "Why do you say that?" Hugild arched her eyebrows.
"Because if you become empress, my dear, then ladies will look to you to set the fashions of the future."
That was an entirely new way of looking at the situation. Sarah had never considered the possibility that Lady Corinne might perceive her as a threat to her power and station. The insight gave her an added measure of self-confidence.
"Oh, I think I see it," Hugild said excitedly. "Look!"
Sarah turned back to the railing and caught her first glimpse of the famous manor.
"Oh my,"
she gasped in wonderment. While it certainly did not rival Lochhaven in size, the monstrous rock supporting Pavenham Sky was the largest Sarah had ever seen under a single sky mansion. But it wasn't just one floating mountain. There were several, linked together with giant iron cables. Most of the lower ones featured sculpted gardens, but some had elegant servants' quarters, too. There were multiple tiers ending on the ground, and Sarah saw zephyrs floating up from the gardens to bring guests to the main island in the air. The main manor was huge, the structure 4 stories high with a triangular facade on the front with parapets. The landing yard in front of the entrance held no fewer than 7 tempests, each one hovering in place with room to spare. As they neared, Sarah gaped at the Admiral's private hurricane moored to the side with a giant chain. There must be an army of servants to work the grounds, she realized.
"Look! The sea!"
Hugild's voice showed how impressed she was. Sarah saw that the manor was moored in the sky above a long stretch of cliffs that joined with the sea. Waves crashed on the immaculate beaches beneath the edge of the manor, offering a grand view. The grounds on the cliffs were all sculpted with lawns and hedges and pathways. There were people walking down below, but no homes or dwellings, just private gazebos and benches. It was the most picturesque place Sarah could imagine. Everywhere she looked, there were exorbitant displays of wealth, from the bronzed shingles of the main estate down to the lampposts on the stair rails leading to the beaches. This is why she is famous, Sarah breathed. Who wouldn't want to live here? Or visit?
Do you see the fog? Hugild asked. Look, it's almost like a wall of it is being held back.
The bank of fog was restrained by some force to provide a perfect view of the land below. Instantly she felt the desire to live at such a place, to be surrounded by such luxury. She had never understood covetousness before. There'd been no need. But the feeling was powerful. How strange that just seeing something grand could trigger such urges. Their tempest slowed its approach as it descended to the main manor. The manor looked to be at least a century old, if not more. But the outer buildings all looked younger. Much of the growth had happened during the Admiral's rise to power. Sarah nearly asked Hugild how she looked, but she caught herself in time. Confidence. Confidence was key. Lady Corinne was worried about her. How was that even possible? The pilot of the Tempest swung lower yet, easing down to an open position at the end of the line. The other Tempests were all likely owned by the families of the other girls chosen to represent the Empire to the Prince of King Fountain. When had the others arrived? Her stomach was doing somersaults, but she tried to exude calmness. The breeze was pleasant, with a savory smell of the ocean at its tip. The only smells wafting up to Lockhaven from the city were sulfurous ones. She could hear the crash of the surf in the distance, the sigh of the waters receding. Such heavenly music. Then she noticed there was also music piping from the main house. The crew lowered a gangplank, since it would be unladylike for her to climb down a rope ladder. Sarah descended to the landing platform, careful not to trip over her long skirts. Her silk gloves went up to her elbows. She had chosen not to wear jewelry because the event had been described as an afternoon excursion, not a state ball. A handsome middle-aged man met her at the bottom of the ramp, wearing an expensive uniform comprising a coat, a buttoned shirt, breeches, and boots with too many buckles.
"Welcome to Pavenham's Sky, ma'am," he said with a charming smile. "I am Lord Lockton's butler, Master Sewell. Your Highness, you do us great honor in accepting the mistress's invitation. Was the journey from Lockhaven pleasant?"
"Indeed, Master Sewell," Sarah replied. He offered his arm to escort her, and she placed her hand on top of his forearm, as was the etiquette for such an occasion. Hugild followed behind, along with some of Sarah's bodyguards, but they joined the other servants and remained behind. Sewell, who led the way for Sarah, was all grace and wit. He complimented her on her gown, her hairstyle, and even her smile. All words designed to put her at ease and make her feel welcome and comfortable. The intent was likely to manipulate her into lowering her guard. She was having none of it. They passed the Tempests floating at their respective berths, each one containing crew that had not been invited to join the festivities. Sewell then led her to the triple arches that fronted the estate. And when they passed beneath the shadowed lip, she felt the presence of the Leerings hiding there. It gave her the sensation of being watched, but then the Leerings always made her feel that way. The path opened to a courtyard as soon as they passed through the arches, revealing a massive square of gray stone. There was a fountain in the middle, beyond which twin stairs zigzagged up to a massive double door that was probably 18 feet tall. It was capped by a triangular casement level with enormous windows. Indeed, windows gazed down at her from almost all sides. The patio had been swept recently, and their shoes made stuttering clicks as they walked. Sewell escorted her up the stairway to the right, and when they reached the top, the massive doors swung open. The sound of the instruments grew much louder, and it only took her a moment to realize why. There was a full orchestra on display. The music at Pavenham Sky wasn't teleported in by Leering. No, they had their own music made there. Sarah tried not to stare as she entered the massive hall. The columns, stairs, railings, and banisters were ornate and decorated, some even sheathed in gold. The wealth on display was staggering. It was difficult to wrap her mind around the idea that Lord Lawton had earned the bulk of his fortune through speculation. Most men were ruined by excessive speculation, but his had earned him this. Uniformed servants dressed like the butler stood at attention along the main gallery. Sarah was escorted down the long hall, but she saw a woman approaching her before she reached the double doors at the end. It was Lady Corinne herself. Sarah guessed her to be in her mid-30s. She had obviously been a very young woman when Lord Lawton had married her. What little of her hair that could be seen beneath her fancy hat was brown, but it was her face that intrigued Sarah the most. Lady Corinne was pretty, but not in a particularly exceptional manner. She had a proud mouth, one that seemed to rarely smile, with just a touch of pink applied. Her eyes were grayish-green and deeply serious, showing a keen intelligence. She was not flighty. If anything, she looked a little underwhelmed by the sight of Sarah. If Sarah had been concerned about her lack of jewelry, Lady Corinne wore only two dangling earrings of modest fashion. As she drew close, Lady Corinne stopped and made a gracious bow. Now she did smile, just a little lift to the corners of her mouth, and she inclined her head in greeting.
"Your Highness, welcome," she said.
Sarah recognized her voice, having heard it once before on that fateful afternoon.
"Sewell, if you would introduce us to the gathering, please."
"As you will, mistress,"
Sewell replied with a bow and quickly walked ahead. Lady Corinne came and took Sarah by the arm, not in a possessive way, but so she could speak to her in a confidential tone and be heard.
"I'm grateful you came, Miss Fitzempress."
"Thank you for the invitation," Sarah replied.
"We may not have another moment to speak privately,"
Lady Corinne then said, dropping her voice even lower. They had just passed the gaze of two servants, and now no one stood between them and the rich maple-colored doors that Sewell was preparing to open. Sarah's unease grew even keener.
"Would you be so kind," Lady Corinne asked in a whisper, "as to return these letters to your father? I have not opened them. I do not want to know what is written in them. If he wishes to communicate with me, please inform him to send a note through my husband."
From beneath her vest, she carefully slipped out three folded letters and handed them to Sarah. The scrawled directives on the envelopes were indeed in his handwriting. The seals were all still intact. As Sarah took them, Lady Corinne gave her an imploring look.
"We have been an ally of your father's for many years, but these signs of familiarity must end. If you please, Miss Fitzempress, I would appreciate you returning them to him with my message."
I will," Sarah stammered. The letters were burning in her fingers. Mr. Sewell pulled open the doors. Chapter 23. Deed of Servitude. It was almost impossible for Sarah to focus on the conversations happening that afternoon in Lady Corinne's sitting room. She had tucked the letters away, but she quivered with indecision about what to do with them. Yes, she had said she would return them to her father. But she was keenly interested in opening them and learning their secrets. Was her father trying to instigate something untoward with the Lady of Pavenham Sky? And if he was disrespecting her in such a way, would his behavior disqualify him for the throne? Sarah felt little loyalty to the man now, so she was primarily concerned with her own self-interest. He had tried to convince the world that Sarah wasn't his true offspring. This could be an opportunity to get revenge, to humiliate him. That alone was tempting enough. But Lady Lawton had clearly intended for the indiscretion to be concealed. Making an enemy of such a powerful woman would be fraught with its own risks. Was Lady Corinne testing her? Sarah's instincts were so knotted up and twisted that she couldn't begin to unravel them. Ceddie would have known what to do. She was always so clear-headed. How she missed her friend. Then there was the strangeness of this invitation to Pavenham Sky. Why gather together the rivals for the Prince of King Fountain's affections? What did the lady stand to gain or lose from the arrangement? Lady Corinne led the conversation, directing questions toward each of the young ladies present. Some of the questions were political. Which ministry would rule next? How did they feel about the trade disputes between such and such realms? What speculations were they involving themselves in? Others were more personal, like amounts they would inherit, other lands they had traveled to, their choice of study and school. Sarah waited for a question to be directed at her, but so far Lady Corinne had exempted her from the conversation. The mistress of Pavenham Sky never revealed what she thought on any of the subjects, and Sarah believed this was done on purpose. It helped the lady of the house maintain her privacy and superiority. Each of the young ladies was very wealthy and established. Most had finished their schooling the previous year and had passed the test. One or two were on the cusp of finishing, though Sarah was easily the youngest of them all, and the smallest. While she listened to the questions, she observed the servants coming in and carefully and quietly replacing trays of food and drink. They were all uncommonly handsome young men dressed in uniforms that matched the chief butler's. Mr. Sewell remained in attendance for the entire event, giving directions with discreet gestures of his hands and fingers, sometimes just a nod. He was always attuned to Lady Corinne, watching her closely, as if trying to anticipate what she might desire. After an hour or so passed thusly, Lord Lawton entered the study and was announced. Lady Corinne gave him a private smile and joined him before introducing him to each of the young ladies assembled. He was kind and gracious, and Sarah noticed how Lady Corinne doted on him, watching his every move just like the butler did for her. She clung to his arm, smiled when she spoke to him, and caressed his sleeve. It was plain for all to see that Lady Corinne admired her husband, and he treated her with respect and tenderness in return. It was an unfamiliar sight for Sarah, a sharp contrast to her own parents' dynamic. A sudden clattering sound jarred the tranquility. One of the servants had fumbled a tray. It didn't fall, but the contents had rattled and drawn attention. Mr. Sewell rubbed the bridge of his nose, clearly displeased by the disturbance. The servant was a young man, probably no more than 20. He was the only one who wore his hair in a queue, tied in the back with a black piece of ribbon. Like the other servants, he was exceptionally well-built and handsome, and he looked chagrined by his mistake. Sarah felt a throb of pity. He wasn't reprimanded, but the mood in the room altered slightly at his gaffe, the only imperfection that had infiltrated the event, and Sarah noticed some of the other young ladies smirking in derision. Mr. Sewell approached the young man and whispered something in his ear. The young man nodded and hastily lifted the tray to carry it out. "And this is Miss Seraphine Fitzempress, of course," Lady Corinne said, startling her. She hadn't realized she'd been so distracted by that little scene. Lord Lawton stood before her. This was not the first time they had been introduced. Although he was not a member of the Privy Council, his presence at court was not uncommon. Sarah rose and bowed to him while he did the same. "Lord Lawton, it's a pleasure to see you again. I think it has been a year, has it not?"
"It was the 27th, to be exact, 1 year ago,"
he replied smoothly. He was one of the most mild-mannered men she knew, rivaling Lord Fitzroy in his gallantry.
"My condolences about your grandfather, young lady. He was an honorable man."
"Thank you, Lord Lawton," she replied. "This is my first visit to Pavenham Sky. It does you credit, sir. I hope we have an opportunity to explore the grounds this afternoon."
"Most of our visitors desire that,"
he answered with another bow.
"I would recommend seeing the cliffs at sunset. The view is quite stunning. There have been no portents of a storm, either. It should be quite safe."
"That would be delightful," Sarah answered, pleased. "Miss Fitzempress," Lady Corinne said with a sly air, "has always wanted to visit the poor, have you not? Why, I believe your companion at school was from the Fells. What did you learn from that experience?" Sarah suddenly found herself the focus of everyone's attention. Was the question innocent? There was something in Lady Corinne's tone that suggested it wasn't. No, her host had excluded her from the previous questions to put her at ease, to put her off her guard. Now she would strike and see how Sarah reacted. Sarah's courage rose to the occasion. "I adore her completely," Sarah said effusively. "She is probably the best student at the school. What do you think, Lord Lawton? Should knowledge of the mysteries be kept secret except for those of privilege, or should they be opened to all who have the aptitude to master them?" She shifted her focus to him and saw Lady Corinne's eyes narrow just a little in her peripheral vision.
"It is a complex issue, surely," he replied evasively. "What do you think?"
It would be easy to state her own opinions on the subject. She held strong ones. But she recognized this game they were playing. She would let them win if she revealed her own position before requiring them to reveal theirs. So often, people spurted their own ideas without learning from others. Asking good questions was the key to wisdom. "I am only 16, Lord Lawton," Sarah replied with a sad shake of her head. "You have lived longer and have seen much more of the world. I would value hearing your insights on the subject, if you please." Lady Corinne's eyes narrowed a little more. Lord Lawton was nonplussed.
"It has been my experience that the prejudices of those living below preclude them from having the clarity of mind necessary for the rigors of mastery of thought."
She was grateful to have had Mr. Durant as her advisor for so many years. She was used to language that concealed. The law had always been something she'd excelled at. "What you are saying, then, is that they lack the rigid self-discipline required or attained by patient study and determination?"
"Quite so," he answered.
"But if they do not lack rigid self-discipline or determination, should they be precluded from harnessing the gifts they possess and enlarging them as we do?" Sarah was going out of her way to use the fanciest words she could summon to mind. A wry smile came to Lord Lawton's face.
"Every person is capable of enlargement. Most decide against it."
"What is your reason for thinking so?" She was beginning to enjoy herself, despite the silent pressure of Lady Corinne's cold, assessing gaze.
"Because effort is anathema to them. Most people stay at a task longing for it to end. A man will work 12 hours at a factory each day because he knows when the whistle blows that his labors will no longer be required. They do as little as possible and nothing more. They endure the toil only because it is fixed, and they shirk and slouch and wait until their overseer's eyes are turned away before halting their efforts entirely. A reprimand is preferable to arduous work. That is my experience, Miss Fitzempress, with those who dwell below."
Almost timed to his words, the servant who had been surreptitiously trying to exit the room with his tray collided with the door. The tray, the goblets, and the dirty dishes all came smashing down at once with a dreadful clamor. Everyone turned their heads at once, and the young man, who now bore a smear of white sauce across his black and gold jacket, went instantly scarlet with humiliation. Lord Lawton's eyes became like flint, but he said nothing. Mr. Sewell rushed to the scene and scolded the young man in sharp undertones, his nostrils flaring. The young women in the room began to titter and laugh, and some of the other servants broke their composure as well. Soon the room was in an uproar.
"I don't recognize him," Lord Lawton said to his wife. "Is he new?"
"Very new, husband," she sighed. "My apologies." He shook his head curtly.
"He will learn. Don't let Mr. Sewell dismiss him. It's just a mistake."
The poor young man's embarrassment was evident. He knelt on the floor, trying to pick up the broken pieces with his white gloves as the butler continued to chastise him for causing a scene. Sarah was not laughing. She glanced around at the other young women, taking in their looks of disdain and mockery. They had never carried a heavy tray in their lives. Sarah could not imagine doing so herself without fumbling. The injustice of their behavior made her blood seethe. She was impulsive, probably too impulsive, but she could not sit quietly and abide their laughter. It grated on her and made her rage inside. "Excuse me," Sarah said to the Lawtons. She quickly strode up to the young man kneeling in disgrace and bent down and started collecting the broken pieces. "I'm so sorry this happened," she said to him in a kindly way. The laughter in the room ceased immediately, as if the surf from the cliffs below had suddenly risen and drowned everyone. She would probably be shunned from Lady Corinne's inner circle forever because of her bold act. She didn't care. The young man looked at her in startled surprise. He probably knew who she was. She picked up a few more pieces and hurriedly set them on the tray. "It was just a little mistake," she said, trying to laugh. Everyone was staring at her now. Her fingers felt like they belonged to someone else. She could imagine the looks coming her way, but she refused to glance backward. She was shaming them all by helping him. Suddenly, there were three more servants crouching nearby, their eyes wide with shock as they quickly collected the broken fragments together. A stab of pain in her index finger told her that she'd cut herself on one of the slivers. She bit her lip and clenched her fist. The glove was made of silk. Of course it hadn't protected her from the shard.
"Did you cut yourself?"
Mr. Sewell asked in her ear.
"Let me see it."
"It's nothing," she replied, coming to her feet. The scraps were all collected on the tray, and another servant carried it swiftly from the room. Mr. Sewell shot a look of daggers at the young victim who had caused the scene.
"Go change at once," he hissed.
The young man bobbed his head.
"Yes, Mr. Sewell, of course."
He was much taller than Sarah. He had warm brown eyes and an embarrassed smile.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Sewell." "Just go," said the butler, straining to be civil.
Sarah watched him leave, noticing again the black ribbon tying back his queue. The room was no longer silent. She heard the murmurs and whispers from the young ladies gathered there. Sarah felt the sting on her finger still, and when she looked at it, she saw her glove was stained with a splotch of red right at the knuckle. She looked back at the young man who had reached the door. He'd opened it, but paused at the threshold to look back at her. The embarrassed smile was gone. He was grinning at her, positively grinning. The sheepish look was gone. She saw keen intelligence in his eyes. He gave her a small nod and then left. It was then she heard a whisper in her mind. It was so faint she wondered at first if she'd imagined it. It was like a flash of insight, a nudge to her thoughts. "The Prince of King Fountain." Of course he was. What other servant would be allowed to make such a fumble at Lady Corinne's notoriously perfect manner? As the idea bloomed in her mind, she realized that their arrival at Pavenham Sky was more than just a social call. They were all on display for him.
Chapter 24. The Cliffs.
After the experience in Lady Corinne's sitting room, Sarah immediately began to doubt the premonition she had received. Did she simply have an overactive imagination? None of the other young ladies seemed the least aware that the bumbling servant was anything out of the ordinary. None of the ladies behaved in a very friendly way with one another. They were rivals, after all, and that put them all on insecure footing. After the refreshments and discussion ended, Lady Corinne announced that they would be visiting the lavish gardens of the estate together, culminating in a walk along the beach at low tide. Everyone seemed eager to participate. The manor had a fleet of zephyrs, and the girls were to be sent to the lower gardens in groups of five or six. Sarah shared a bench with Lady Wilkins' daughter, Penelope, whom she greeted warmly.
"If you don't mind my asking, Miss Fitzempress," Penelope said, "why did you stoop to help that clumsy servant? It wasn't your fault he spilled the tray."
"Does it matter whose fault it was?" Sarah answered, not caring for the girl's reproachful tone. "He was made into an object of ridicule."
Yes, but he is only a deeded servant. I should think you wouldn't have done that in the Prince Regent's household.
Perhaps, but I haven't lived in my father's household in quite a few years, Sarah answered.
Oh, said the other girl in an obnoxious tone. I'd quite forgotten. He tried to disown you.
Really, Miss Fitz-Empress, let the servants alone.
Your attention to their station does them no good. It does you no good either.
What do you mean? Sarah asked, trying to control her temper. Another girl sitting across the aisle spoke up.
You would make them equal to us? She said.
It was Lord Mortensen's daughter, who had vast wealth and high connections. Your assumption is, Sarah countered, that because of the privilege of your birth they are not already equal.
There is no chance or coincidence, she answered haughtily. We were born in our station, and they to theirs.
But is it not possible for even your family to fall, Miss Mortensen? Is there not a chance of that happening? The girl gave her a sulky look.
For every speculation to succeed, someone must fail. There is a winning side and a losing side of every bet. My parents are betting that your father will be chosen as the new emperor. I think they are right.
Sarah felt her cheeks begin to flush with heat. If they are wrong, you've chosen your words unwisely.
I don't really care, Miss Mortensen replied stiffly. Soon I'll be living at the court of King Fountain. I think it will suit me better.
You are so vainglorious, Ingith, teased another girl. The prince will not choose you. He will choose me.
Sarah thought about the young man who had dropped all the dishes. She kept her feelings to herself. The gardens of Pavenham Sky were wondrous, and each had a different style and variety of vegetation. From one level, Sarah could look over and see the next farther below. Some were even joined together with floating boulders connected by iron railings or bridges so that guests could walk from one to another. The variety of flower breeds was astonishing, and they were distinguished by painted placards identifying them. It was whispered that the gardens were Lady Corinne's legacy, that she painstakingly directed the gardeners on how to arrange them. During their walks, each of the young women present sought an individual audience with Sarah, and it emerged that they were evenly divided in supporting her and her father. Again, she thought of the letters she'd been given and wondered how their contents might sway the vote in her favor. She would feel better about making her own decision if she better understood Lady Corinne's motives. In watching her, Sarah tried to understand her personality and her character. The lady was intensely focused, and while she did possess deep knowledge of the gardens, she revealed very little about herself, choosing instead to draw out the girls she'd invited to the event. All except for Sarah. After visiting the gardens, they took the zephyrs down to the cliffs and walked along the well-tended footpath. It led to a stone pavilion where there was seating and a giant ring of fire, fueled by four smaller leerings. The flames rippled and danced in the wind from the cliffs. Near the dining area, there was a small kitchen and serving area where the servants had gathered to prepare the evening's meal. Sarah spied the servant from earlier among them, his uniform clean. He watched the procession go by but avoided her eyes. Was that deliberate? At the crook of the trail, a stairwell of timber slats had been built into the cliffside. It was very steep, and despite the iron railings lining the stone, some of the girls were unsure of themselves and their footing. Sarah had climbed the tor many times at Mirwood and found the descent easy. The sun was descending on the western horizon, lowering above the flat gray waters that extended into the distance. When they reached the beach, there were officers from the Ministry of War stationed there as bodyguards. Some of the young women teased and flirted with them, but the soldiers remained focused on their duty. Seeing the uniforms made Sarah think of Will Russell, and her heart fluttered. How soon would he arrive at the city with the batch of letters? The irony of that thought made her sigh. Piles of bleached driftwood were gathered against the walls at the bottom of the cliffs. There was so much of it that others had used it to build makeshift structures like benches and huts. The gentle shushing of the waves came and went, and Sarah's eyes were fixed on the moving waters when she caught sight of something that made her gape in surprise. The beach had collected another piece of driftwood that was impossibly huge.
"Look! Look at that!" said Penelope Wilkins in wonder.
It was a tree, massive and tall, that had been uprooted and washed ashore who knew how many years before. The bark had all been stripped from it, giving it the same bleached look as the other trees. The root ball was 5 times taller than a man, a mass of tentacles frozen in rigor mortis. The silvered trunk tapered away from the root ball, but it was easily 2 or 3 times as wide as a human was tall. As Sarah stared at the fallen tree, an intense craving to climb it seized her, flooding her with memories from childhood.
"I have never seen a tree so big," said Miss Mortensen. "It's gigantic."
"It came from that outcropping of rock," explained Lady Corinne, joining the group assembled on the beach. She gestured toward a small mountain jutting up from the waves farther along the beach. The cliffs were all scarred and battered by the surf, but the crown of the hill was green and covered with tall evergreen trees. None was so massive as the one that had fallen.
"Did it really?"
asked Miss Mortensen with interest.
"You can reach that mound by skyship," Lady Corinne answered. "There is a crater where it grew before."
"Can we go there next?" asked another girl excitedly.
"No, there are no trails there. It is very rugged and dangerous. The best view is from here on the beach."
"What is that tree called?"
asked another girl, knowing Lady Corinne was an expert on all the names.
"It's called a shuisa. The bhikkhu named it. It means water fir. They only grow on the coast or high in the mountains. If you were to cross the waters to the north, you would reach the principality of Prairie. The trees come from there and are very ancient. This one fell long ago, and the waters washed it up on shore. It has settled in the sand and has never moved since. The trunk is nearly petrified now. Come feel it."
All the girls, including Sarah, were eager to do just that. They joined together at the fallen tree and explored it, while Lady Corinne watched them with interest. Sarah grazed her hand along the silvery trunk. What she wouldn't give to have seen the mighty tree fall from the cliff and land in the water. There were still some broken limbs that would have made good ladders, and she found herself longing again to climb up it. It was clearly wide enough for her to walk down the length. Shoving the impulsive thought away, she walked into the shadow beneath the trunk and admired the mass of roots. The sand near the cluster was compact and wet, showing that part of the roots would be submerged when the tide was up. She definitely had enjoyed the gardens and the beach more than the sumptuously decorated manor, which she couldn't currently see because of the cliffs. The beach was a treasure, owned by one family. Enjoyed by one family and those whom they invited to visit. It was a shame to guard such a secret. The group of ladies lingered on the beach until the sun set, something they watched together. It was a unique moment for Sarah. She'd never seen the sun get swallowed by the sea in quite such a manner. When it was gone, a zephyr came off the mountain and joined them on the beach. "The tide will come in soon," said Lady Corinne. "It is time for our dinner at the cliff." Many of the girls looked relieved at the sight of the zephyr, which meant they would not need to climb back up the steep stairs.
"I should like to walk back up, Lady Corinne," Sarah heard herself say.
Mr. Durant had always taught her to demand what she expected instead of ask for it. Some of the girls gave her offended looks, some admiring ones.
"By all means," Lady Corinne said. "The guards will see you up."
One of the girls, Miss Gentry, seemed eager to go with her, but she lowered her head after glancing at the other girls. No doubt she was too worried about their opinion of her to risk it. Sarah nodded to Lady Corinne and then started back up the beach. The cliffs did look imposing, but she knew she could handle the ascent. The cove had a magical air, and she regretted that she could not stay down below to watch the tide come in. The others gathered into the zephyr, which instantly lifted them up to the height of the cliff, and Sarah began walking up the pathway. Two soldiers